The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. In more than 40 years of writing about whiskey, Charles McLean has achieved global recognition and no shortage of accolades for his work. He's a master of the Quake, the highest honour in the Scotch whisky industry, and a member of the Whisky Magazine Hall of Fame. In fact, he was also its founding editor. Charles has written 18 books and counting on whisky. His magnum opus, Malt Whisky, was first published in 1997. It's been translated into 9 languages and was the recipient of a prestigious Glenfiddich Award. His 2003 book, Scotch Whisky, A Liquid History, won the James Beard Award for Best Wine and Spirits Book. And in June 2021, Charles's service to Scotch whisky were further recognised in the Queen's Birthday Honours List. He was appointed an MBE, a member of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. So stay with me this episode as Charles and I discuss some of his career highlights, his love-hate relationship with writing, and what it's like to taste ultra-aged whiskies retailing at more than $100,000 a bottle. Charles shares his insights on the age-old debate of blends versus single malts, the resurrection of the legendary Brora and Port Ellen Scotch whisky distilleries, and his opinion on Tasmanian whisky after visiting in 2019. Charles McLean, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
My pleasure.
Before we go any further, I should congratulate you for your MBE.
Oh, that's very kind of you, James. Thank you very much indeed. It came as a complete surprise, but nevertheless, it's fantastic to be, you know, recognised, if you like. And there aren't that many people in the Scotch whisky industry who have gongs, so it's an exclusive club, as it were.
If you take yourself back to 1981 when you started writing about whisky, I bet you couldn't have possibly imagined where this career would have taken you.
Yeah, you bet. I only wish my dad was still alive because as you may know, I spent most of the 70s trying to decide what the hell I was going to do. And I did 2 degrees, one in art history and the other in law, and then qualified as a solicitor. And even by the time I qualified, I knew that the law was not for me. And my poor dad despaired. What's he going to do with himself? And I set up my plate as a literary agent and then started to write ghostwriting initially and then freelance advertising copywriting. And it was through the copywriting that I was taken into whisky, because the first job was for Bell's in 81, as you say. Hand to mouth. It's always had to be hand to mouth, even now. I don't know where my next meal's coming from, as it were, the work has come in, and I think my dad would be proud of me, even though he never really understood what I did after I abandoned the law. And just by chance, I should think a dozen major jobs came from the whisky industry or from various brands, Macallan, Glenmorangie, Allied Distillers, the nascent United Distillers in the late 80s. Writing company brochures, writing brand publications and this sort of thing. So come 1988, I didn't have a book on the back burner, but had enough track record and enough interest, for goodness sake, in Scotch whisky to make a fist of a proposal to a publisher for a book about Scotch whisky. And the rest, as they say, is history. I've completed now my 18th book and hasn't yet appeared. So it goes on. So it's I don't regret getting out of the law, I must say.
That 18 books, that number's gone up a bit since I read your biography, or maybe you need to update your website, I'm not sure.
I think I do. I've written 5 books since the lockdown.
Wow.
2 of them were relatively short books to accompany very eye-wateringly expensive bottles of whiskey. One was a Karazawan 72 or something, and one was a very old Glen Grant. And so these were sort of, you know, books to accompany these expensive bottles. The others were, one was a radical update of a book that I wrote and published in 1997, Malt Whiskey. And then the other two were a book about blended Scotch whiskey, which I've always been very interested in blended Scotch. And that was for, again, an American publisher. And then the last one was a book with the working title, A History of Whiskey in 100 Objects, based on the very successful book, History of the World in 100 Objects.
Which of your books are you most proud of?
I think probably Malt Whiskey. That was breaking new ground because there wasn't anything exactly like it around at that time. Oh, and the other one that I would say, which nearly broke my back, was Scotch Whiskey, A Liquid History. Now, that's a fairly intense book. Originally, I was told that I had 120,000 words to play with. And then the publishing house changed, the editor changed twice, actually, and the because this was a five-year project. But the editor then said, oh, the text had to be cut to no more than 80,000 words. Well, I was already at about 115,000 words. And I despaired, and I said, "Well, I wasn't going to do it. I cut it as you like." And they did put on a brilliant scholarly editor who specialised in academic texts, and he cut it, but he cut out all the sort of anecdotal stuff, you know. So that's why it's why I described it as being quite intense. But the that's been the basis, really, of my education in whiskey, because it required a huge amount of research. I quite enjoy the research, although it is rather like being constipated, and the relief of when you start to write, you know, you load all the information into your head, and then you wait and see how it's going to come out, and then when it does come out, you write as long as you can. It's a funny process, really.
I've seen you write that you have a love-hate relationship with your writing. What did you mean by that?
As a, if you like, a professional writer, you can't claim to have writer's block, you know. And I'm writing nonfiction, of course. I'm not imaginative enough to write fiction. I really admire fiction writers. But the love-hate is that there's no greater buzz than when it's going well. And there's nothing more frustrating than when it's not going well. When you're churning through stuff and, you know, to some extent you can over-research and you become bamboozled. You know, there's just so much information, and trying to order it and trying to put it into some coherent shape, it can be very frustrating. So that's why it's sort of love and hate. But by and large, it's love. It's a fantastic feeling when you write something which you're happy with or you know, your publisher is happy with. It's a terrific feeling.
Now, you mentioned before that you'd written some of the accompanying books for some of these ultra-aged or extremely rare whiskies. And I know you've been, you know, you've done some work with some of the 70-plus-year-old whiskies. I'm just interested to know, you know, for those of us that are never likely to taste a whiskey of that kind of age, is it worth the hype? Is it an experience unlike any other?
Yes and no. About a fortnight ago, I was writing tasting notes on the oldest whiskey that will, up to date, will be released later this year, an 80-year-old Glenlivet. Now, this will retail at £80,000 the bottle. I think they've got about 120 bottles. There's not that many of them. But it's been released by Gordon and MacPhail from Elgin. And they asked me to write tasting notes. And thank God, it was absolutely unbelievable. It was a fantastic whiskey. There's a strange feeling when you're tasting a whiskey, an old whiskey. This one was distilled in 1940. And and you think what was happening in 1940 and all this sort of stuff. But quite apart from that, that sort of romantic association, just from an analytical perspective, from an objective perspective, the aroma and the taste and the overall flavor was just unbelievable. But there again, age is not a guarantee of quality or satisfaction. Old whiskies obviously go down in strength. If it dips below 40, it cannot be sold as Scotch whiskey. But when you're coming down to 41, 42, 43%, some of them, they get a bit flat. first thing. But also they can be over-influenced by flavors coming from the wood. I don't mean woody tastes. I mean what's called the distillery character is completely subsumed by the mature character, by the flavors coming from the wood. So really, with a lot of these old whiskies, it's extraordinarily difficult to tell where they've come from. And that is not 100% desirable. Ideally, you want to retain a balance of mature character and distillery character. One of the most interesting things about these old whiskies is trying to work out why flavor has changed. Has it changed at all? But there's no doubt when you're looking at whiskies which were distilled in the 1960s, even the early 70s, they're different from their contemporary equivalents. Have they changed in the bottle? Impossible to tell because you haven't got a reference sample to compare it with. Was the liquid different when it was filled into the bottle? And I think the answer to that is yes, different from what it is today for a huge range of reasons. On balance, these very old whiskies, the 40-year-olds, etc., generally they're hugely rewarding. The price, of course, is simply what people are prepared to pay for them. And to some extent, today, within the last 15 years, the price has been distorted by investors. Because some whiskies, by no means all, but some have been fetching huge prices, as you know, at auction. So therefore, the brand owner, when they're releasing an old whiskey, they know that it might well be flipped. In other words, the buyer would then immediately put it up for auction. So it's not unreasonable for them to ask a much larger price than would have been. Port Ellen, the first Port Ellen bottled by Diageo was released in 2001. It was, I think, 27 years old. And the price was £95. That same bottle would probably fetch £2,500 to £3,000 at auction today. And of course, Diageo thought, well, wait a minute now. You know, why should these punters, these gamblers, make the money when it's our product? And so they immediately start to raise the price, which pissed off consumers. But it's not unreasonable, really. And nowadays, of course, with the arrival of these investors. So you had consumers and you had collectors. Now you've got consumers, collectors, and investors. And investors, when stock markets are flat and they're looking for alternative investments, Scotch was rated very, very high. Indeed, 2 years ago, the Knight Frank Wealth Report ranked it as the number one alternative investment based on the price achieved at auction. Higher prices achieved at auction than gold, fine art, wine, motor cars, coins, stamps, you know, all the usual things, alternative investment. So there's nothing you can do about it. But it means that a lot of these whiskies are priced beyond the consumer's reach, you know, which is a shame.
I think a lot of them already were beyond many of our reach anyway. You mentioned Port Ellen just then. We've obviously seen Diageo investing in resurrecting the Brora and Port Ellen distilleries. And they talk about the meticulous attention to detail, replicating where possible the distillation regimes and spirit character of the original distilleries. Is it possible for them to, you know, start making Port Ellen again exactly as it was before the distillery was shuttered?
I have my doubts, quite frankly. You'd probably make a pretty decent approximation. They've got all the books, and indeed Port Ellen, the detailed accounts of the distilling regime, of the parts per million phenols of the malt. And there are still men alive who worked at these distilleries before they closed. So the details of how they went about it is known. Certainly Brora has reproduced the equipment, and how the kit was run will be as close as possible. But then you get into things, these grey areas like barley varieties. In the 1960s, a new variety was introduced called Golden Promise, which was very, very popular by both brewers and distillers in Scotland because it grew well in Scotland. Prior to that, most of the barley coming into the system actually came from abroad, some from Australia, some from Canada, some from Northern Europe, and also from Anglesey, of course, from England. But the varieties of those days, they were low-yielding. They were difficult to grow in the Scottish climate. That's why they were imported. But Golden Promise did the trick. It matured early. It had a short straw, so it could withstand wind, etc. Now, the general feeling of the whiskey industry, Scotch whiskey industry, has long been that the actual variety doesn't have a great impact on flavor. So varieties are being produced and tested every year, all the time. In terms of yield, and two kinds of yield, yield to the farmer, the amount of grain that you can get per hectare of ground, but also the yield of alcohol. Golden Promise, for example, would yield, I think, about 370 litres of pure alcohol per tonne. Nowadays, you're looking at barleys which are yielding 420. So there's been a huge improvement. Does this impact on flavour? Well, I remember tasting some new make spirit at Benromach Distillery when Gordon MacPhail had bought it and had re-established it, and they'd done various tests with various barley varieties. And three, to me, I couldn't tell the difference. But one was outstanding. It was rich and buttery, oily, and that was Golden Promise. Some of the new distilleries that have opened in Scotland are looking at going back to old-fashioned barley varieties or trying different hybrids, because for them, flavour is prime, of course. For the established distilleries, most of the make still today goes for blending. And yeast, you see, the other thing, in the period that we're talking about, 60s, 70s, they tended to use a mix of brewer's yeast and distiller's yeast. Nowadays, pretty universally in Scotland, they've got over to distiller's yeast because it makes for a more consistent fermentation and so therefore a more consistent product at the end of the day. Again, some of the newcomers are exploring different yeasts because they don't necessarily want their make to be entirely consistent. You know, they don't need it, because consistency is required by blenders. And if they're going to have to rely on selling their make as single malt, the consumer is looking for variety and will understand if there are subtle differences between one batch and another. It's part of the fun of exploring. So you see, the upshot of what I'm saying is that even with replica equipment and replica management of that equipment, there are things like barley varieties or yeast. Fermentation times, by and large, the fermentation times have lengthened, which is a good thing, because your first fermentation, with the yeast fermentation, will be complete in about 48 hours. And if you want to distill then, you're going to get a spirit with a sort of malty character. If you want to go beyond that to develop fruity floral characteristics, you need to leave it longer. Most distilleries now are leaving it longer, and some of these new distilleries are leaving it an extraordinary length of time, you know, 120, 140 hours. And then the final thing, of course, is wood management. Wood management has developed hugely in the last 30 years, 25 years. You know, I mean, the understanding of what happens during maturation has increased massively. In the times when Brora and Port Ellen, for example, closed 83, 85, they were filling casks. As long as they held the liquid, they were filled. So they tended to be much more exhausted than the casks that would be chosen today. I don't know. It'll be very interesting to see whether they manage to replicate the former spirit. But there again, there are no sort of eight-year-old Broras around, so far as I'm aware, you know, to do your comparison.
You're on the record as saying many times that, you know, you prefer blends to single malts when it comes to relaxing with a dram as opposed to, you know, assessing whiskey. Maybe you could explain why that is.
Simply, James, that malt whiskey for me is work. Most days I'm writing tasting notes for a couple of cask samples on my desk. So when I taste a malt whiskey, I immediately go into work mode, nosing, tasting, considering. With a blend, it's just down the hatch. I'm aware of it, obviously, but I find blends, for me, they just hit the spot. Obviously, they reward consideration, but they don't have to be considered, do you know, if that makes sense.
Are single malts fundamentally more complex? Because I guess when you see the array of different single malts components that can go into a blend, you would think that they could be every bit as complex or perhaps more so.
Well, yeah, except that the job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour. It's what they call an integrated flavour complex. The malts are all sort of overlapping on a base of grains in such a way as to produce an overall flavor complex. Within that, it's extremely difficult by design to identify organoleptically the individual component malts. Now, obviously, there are some blends that want a little bit of smokiness. For most of the Johnny Walker blends, for example, part of the house style is to allow a little bit of smokiness to come through in varying degrees, obviously more in red and black than in blue. But the blender is trying to create this complex. Single malt whiskies, by contrast, are more open. It's, if you like, easier to identify individual aromas, particularly aromas and tastes. I mean, obviously there are only five primary tastes, but the overall impact in the mouth. So that, in other words, the flavor, flavor being a combination of smell, taste, and texture. And it's easier to identify with practice the components that build up this whiskey. So that's why, if you like, malt whiskies are more complex. They seem more complex, although, as you rightly say, blended whiskey generally is arguably more complex because of all its components. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. You also speak about what a fan you are of Johnny Walker Black Label. Has that changed much over the years that you've been drinking it?
Yeah, yes, it has, but not as much as some blends have changed. It's not as smoky as it was 20 years ago, but it's a very satisfying blend of Scotch. It's a benchmark. Interesting enough, you know, when I was the first editor of Whiskey Magazine, as you may know, in the late 90s, and one of my jobs was to interview people in the trade, whether they were collectors or whether they were distillers or blenders or whatever. And my final question was always, apart from the whiskey that you're involved with, which do you have the highest regard for? And I tell you, about 75-80% said Johnny Walker Black Label. It's a very highly regarded whiskey. Also, because of the vast stocks that Diageo hold, they don't need to substitute one malt for another. They've got it already at the right age, in the right wood, to put together their batch by batch by batch. And so you don't get the same variability as happens with some other blends. So yeah, I mean, I don't drink Johnny Walker Black Label all the time by any means. I get mates rates. I advise a company called Adelphi, and they produce a blended Scotch, which I was involved in advising about putting it together. This has been 1993, and I can drink that like mother's milk. And it's made for the company by Ian McLeod and Company. So it's, if you like, an off the peg blend, but adjusted. So that's my daily tipple.
The blends that have changed a lot over time, I'm not asking you to name names, but what has driven those changes? Has it been by design, or has it been a slow sort of evolution that happens when, you know, if a blending house is not watching the ball carefully enough, you know, small changes over a long period of time can add up to a lot, can't they?
Yep. Well, the answer to that is both. Sometimes blends are consciously changed. For example, the huge success of Bell's during the 70s, by about 1980, it was the leading blend in the UK. But the result of the demand, unfortunately, led to a reduction in the malt content and a reduction in the age of fillings. Indeed, it was always said that the Bells were using 3 years in a day, because, of course, whiskey doesn't become whiskey until it's matured for 3 years. In the mid-90s, they changed the blend and gave it an eight-year-old age statement. This was to take on Grouse, which was now battling against Bell's. But then, of course, they found they didn't have enough eight-year-old fillings to sustain the brand. So they again reblended, and they called it Bell's Original. So the current one is the Bell's Original. So that was a conscious change. Another catastrophic change was Black and White, which was a very, very popular brand once upon a time. And in the, I would guess in the 1930s, they were looking at America, and sales in America were declining of Black and White. And yet sales of J&B Rare and Cutty Sark, they were preeminent in that market. And they are both very pale whiskies. There was a rumor that pale whiskies were less fattening than traditional darker colored whiskies. So they released a parallel called Black and White Light. And all that did was confuse bartenders, confuse consumers, and the market dropped even more dramatically, and so it was pulled. So it can be consciously done, like these examples. Or let's say you've got a distillery and a blend, and I've got a distillery and a blend. I want some of your spirit for my blend, and you want some of mine. So I say to you this year, will you fill 100 casks for me? And you say, yep, okay. And I will send you, by the way, my casks, because I know the background to the casks. And then you'll fill them for me with spirit, and either you will mature them in your warehouses and I pay you a little rent, or I will take them away and mature them in my warehouses. You say the same thing to me. Money doesn't change hands because we're trading spirit, you see. But if I run out of the whiskey at the right age or of the right make, for example, if I'm using Glenmorangie, or was using Glenmorangie, and now Glenmorangie, as a single malt, has taken off, that, so far as I'm aware, very little Glenmorangie is available for blending. So suddenly, you know, if you're the owner of Glenmorangie, and I say, I want you to fill me 100 casks, you say, no, you can't have them. I need them all for my single malt whiskey. So I've got to find a substitute for Glenmorangie, let's say. Same might be said of Ardbeg, for example. You know, the Ardbeg, since Glenmorangie actually took it over, has become a sort of cult whiskey, where before it was pretty well entirely used for blending as top dressing, because being a very smoky whiskey, it gives a smokiness to the blend. Do you see what I mean? So I've got to find substitutes. Lagavulin was once a key malt in White Horse, particularly. But now Lagavulin has taken off to such an extent that it's on allocation in pretty well every market. There's not enough to satisfy the demand. So what do I do? So I look to Kalila, for example. I'm sure that the smoky whiskies in the Walker family probably come from the smokiness, shall I say, comes from Kalila, because Kalila's a much bigger distillery and producing, using exactly the same malted specification, same phenolic specification. So therefore, it can happen accidentally. They don't work to a rigorous recipe because it may not be available. They're generally desperately keen to achieve consistency from batch to batch. And they'll go to great lengths to achieve that. But like cooking, they'll have a pinch of this and a pinch of that. The extraordinary thing about them, the blender, is that their memory of smells is phenomenal. And their knowledge of the available malts that they will use in their blends. So then they can think of a substitute, you know. But again, it'll be based upon what they can get, what they've got in their inventory. Therefore, you can get variations. It's called flavor drift. They don't really want it, but it does exist, you know.
You visited Tasmania a couple of years ago, I think it was, 2019.
I did indeed. Yeah, what a trip. Honestly, that was absolutely great, yeah.
What were your impressions of the Tasmanian whiskey industry and Tasmanian whiskey?
Oh, I was very impressed. I was with Bill Lark, and that, of course, helped. We tasted some very, very impressive whiskies. They tend to be very young, and the use of small, very active, highly active casks in your climatic conditions, even Tasmania climatic conditions, you get a very rapid maturation. To develop depth of character, you really need to be able to leave it longer. And this is very difficult in hot climate. They were very impressive whiskies, but they're by necessity really young. And if they could be left longer, I think they would gain depth. I think that a lot of work is being done in this regard by Starward in Melbourne. They benefit from some investment from Diageo Distill Ventures. And so far as I understand, I think that they're filling into larger casks and less active casks, as well as the smaller traditional Australian casks. But I love Tasmania as a place, absolutely adored it. And the people there, oh, it's just a terrific place. I'm dying to get back.
And I noticed you were involved at the recent event, which I attended, the online event for Dictador Rum. Are you dabbling outside whiskey very much with your work in other brown spirits?
No, very much I dabble. Just the former marketing director for Macallan, Ken Greer, he's now an independent consultant and was consulting to Dictador. And they've got this project called the Two Masters series. Ken asked me to write tasting notes for them on the whole series. They were very pleased with those. So then they asked me if I would come out and join them at the launch of this port finished rum. But no, unlike my dear friend and colleague, Dave Broom, who's written extensively about rum, only whiskey do I write about.
Charles, you mentioned some of the books you've been working on this year. When can people expect to look out for those and get their hands on them?
The book that I've been working on about blended Scotch was originally commissioned by the International Wine and Food Society. And so that will appear later this year, but I don't think it's generally publicly available. I think it's really only for members. I've got a much longer version of that, which I plan to work up into a much more detailed book. And if my publisher in Edinburgh takes it, it probably won't be until October next year. And the History of Whiskey in 100 Objects, that again, I think is scheduled for late next year. The two short books, of course, will appear when the bottles are filled. I'm looking forward to doing further research in relation to the blending book, talking to more blenders. And indeed, I think I'm probably going to add a whole section about the histories of well-known blends. That's the only project in my mind at the moment.
Well, Charles, we'll be sure to look out for those. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. It's an honour to talk to you, and congratulations again on the MBE.
Well, that's very kind, James, and I've enjoyed our conversation hugely. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.